Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon to take your calls so that you can participate in the conversation for the next hour by raising questions that you have about the Bible or the Christian faith, and you'd like to see if there's an answer available. Sometimes there is, sometimes there's not. You can also call if you disagree with the answer this host has given to some other person's question previously. You're welcome to do so. The number to call is 844-484-5737, and I'll just tell you, the lines are full at the moment. But if you call in a few minutes, you may get through. The number again is 844-484-5737. As many of you know, the first Wednesday of every month, we have a Zoom meeting in the evening. For us, it's evening, 7 o'clock Pacific time. And anyone around the world is welcome to join us for that. And that's tonight, of course. And sometimes I'm teaching something. Sometimes it's a Q&A. My wife actually thought I was teaching tonight, but I don't think I am. I think I'm just doing Q&A tonight. In any case, one thing, if we do Q&A, it's a lot like this show, except without quite the same time restrictions. We have to get through at an exact time when we're on the radio, of course, and many times at the end of the program, there are some callers waiting who did not get on. With these Zoom meetings, we've been doing it for some years, once a month, and I don't think there's been a time yet where somebody who, was on the Zoom call didn't get on before we finished. I think we got to everybody, as far as I know, at least if they joined early enough and indicated they had a question. So if you'd like to join us, that's at 7 o'clock Pacific time. If you don't know how to get on to Zoom, it's pretty easy. Do go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Look under announcements, and tonight's date is listed there, and the log-on information for getting onto Zoom tonight is there, and you can use that to join us in our Zoom call today, tonight. We're going to talk, first of all, speaking of people from around the world, and Peter from London, England, has been on our Zoom meetings before, and he's also been a caller in the past. Hi, Peter. Welcome.
Hi, Steve. Thank you. I'll ask my short question on the radio and my long question on the Zoom call. Okay. I was just questioning curiosity, really. There have been several times you've mentioned that some Christians get bored with Christ, and as a result, not wanting to misquote you or anything, but as a result, they seek to add things to their walk. So, and this is where you get, especially the sort of Jewish kind of all these different things. I was just curious, what from your opinion, why do Christians get bored of Jesus? Like, how does it happen? Like, is it boring, or what is it?
I don't think there's anything boring about Jesus. And whenever people do get bored with Christ and feel like they have to add something to their Christian walk besides Jesus in order to spice it up or whatever, I always wonder, do they really know Jesus? Have they really met Jesus? You know, I was just reading last week a book about a pastor who was a Southern Baptist pastor for 40 years and seemed to really know, God. At least he was committed to the ministry and so forth, and how he left his faith and became an unbeliever. And, I thought, how can somebody who really knows Jesus do that? Now, I do believe it's possible. But you always have to wonder, if somebody leaves the faith or has to add novelties to their faith, either once or regularly. Some people move from one fad to the next in their Christian faith, and it's very clear that they don't really find Jesus, satisfying. Which, to tell you the truth, if somebody doesn't find Jesus satisfying, I have to suspect they haven't found Jesus, because there is such a thing as finding Jesus, and there's also such a thing as finding religion, which isn't the same thing as finding Jesus, or finding Christianity, which isn't the same thing as finding Jesus either. I mean, that's religion. Finding a place in a church, a set of religious beliefs that that comforts them, a fellowship with people that appeal to them, and they come and they identify themselves as followers of Christ because that's the group they've bought into. But I have to suspect that a lot of people like that just never have met Christ, because I just don't know how anyone could meet Christ and know Christ and then become bored with him. On the other hand, there is that human tendency to become bored with even people who are not the least bit boring, who once fascinated us. How common is it for a couple when they get married to be very infatuated with each other because, you know, each of them is just totally taken with the charm or whatever of the other person, and that charm can be genuine. In many cases it's fake, and then they find that out after they get married. But some people, their spouse is no worse 30 years into their marriage than he or she was, when they got married. But they've just gotten bored for some reason. And this is, of course, I think, sinful. Obviously, you make a vow that you will cherish and love your spouse as long as you both shall live. And that's something that requires deliberate effort sometimes, because there are times when you'd rather be alone. There's times when your spouse may be, annoying or demanding or have other things about them or even distracted, so that, there's just not that emotional thing there anymore. And you can't expect that emotion of the honeymoon necessarily to last through the entire 50 years of marriage. Although I would say, I would hope that a significant portion of it lingers. There would be seasons of coldness, perhaps, or of dullness of emotions toward one another. But I would hope that in general, a couple are always reminding themselves of what it is that drew them to each other initially, and continuing to appreciate it, not to forget it. And I think that is true with a relationship with anybody, and including with Jesus. I mean, people who first come to Jesus, if they really find him, generally speaking, do get pretty excited about it. There's much to be excited about in Jesus. But also, life has its distractions. We get pulled off into other concerns. We have trials. We have low points. And those are actually a natural part of the Christian life, is dead zones in our walk, where we're being tested to see if we're following him only for the emotion or not, where the emotion just isn't there, but he is, but you don't feel him or you don't sense him in the same way. I mean, there's all kinds of phases of a genuine marriage and of a genuine relationship that's a lifelong one with Christ or anyone else. And there are people who really did know Christ, I believe, and who, because of disappointments and trials and people betraying them who shouldn't have, and maybe somebody introducing doubts to them about their faith and so forth, these things accumulate and they don't fight them off. This is the problem. They don't fight them off. It's just like when a couple who love each other drift apart enough that one of them has an affair. Well, that affair probably didn't just happen all of a sudden. It probably happened with, over a period of time. Either the husband or the wife is, ceasing to cultivate that love for the partner. And then, by stages, seeing things attractive about other people or someone else, and they just kind of, people are not static. They are dynamic. We don't just stay the same. We change. But we better direct our direction of change in the right way. We can change for the better, but only if we insist upon it. We can certainly change for the worse if we're careless about it. And we see this all the time. Friendships break down, marriages break down, and people's love for Jesus breaks down. But not for good reasons, but because people change, and those people apparently are not determined to address all the challenges that would incline them to lose their faith or their love for the other party. And I think that happens to people in their Christian lives over the years, too. I know it does. And in some cases, sadly, it results in their just giving up on it, just like some people give up on their marriages. No one does except wimps, frankly. I mean, when a person gives up on their marriage, they're wimping out. they're just not being tough enough to say, wait, I made a promise here. I'm going to keep my promises. It doesn't have to be easy, but I have to be honest, and I'm not going to break my word. That's true in a marriage. That's true following Christ. When you get baptized, you're committing yourself to be a follower of Christ for your whole life. Well, what if the time comes when you're not feeling like it? So what? You made a promise. You stay faithful. You ride it out. You get through the dark spots or the dark tunnels and come out on the other end eventually. But you don't just bail out unless you're a wimp. And frankly, wimps, generally speaking, don't succeed in anything, in any business, in any relationship, or frankly, in a relationship with God. You've got to tough it out. That's why Jesus said to the church in Smyrna, which was being persecuted, and it was very hard for them to stay faithful to Christ. He said, be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. So, I mean, you need to be faithful unto death to your marriage and to all your promises, and to Jesus especially. But people don't realize it's not a cruise. It's a battle. Because there are, as Peter puts it in 1 Peter chapter 2, fleshly lusts that war against your soul. There's also the devil. There's also the world. There's also the opinion of other people. There's a whole bunch of things that can attack your devotion to Christ and to God. But frankly, a Christian is expected to fight those off and to win. And when people don't, then if they're desperately trying to hold on to their Christianity, but they're just not, you know, they've kind of lost touch with Jesus, then they have to find something else that's slightly within the realm of Christianity, they think, maybe a superior form of it that they felt like they'd missed out on. People who get into the Hebrew roots nonsense are of that type. People who get into fascination with signs and wonders, I think, typically are of that type. People who get into some new strange theology, even not a new strange theology. I think some people get into something like, Calvinism because of that. Not because Calvinism is necessarily true, but because it's something new and exciting to learn about, and it maybe promises, they think, to give them the new enthusiasm in their faith that they once had and that they are trying not to lose. Yeah, I think the answer is to devote yourself to Christ more than ever, not to get into distractions that are in addition to Jesus. Jesus himself is enough to anyone who really finds him and knows him. Anyway, Peter, that's my short answer.
Yeah. Yeah, no, thank you, Steve. Yeah, it's a shame, but it's also something to learn from. So, yeah, thank you very much. I know you've got other callers, but I'll see you later on Zoom.
Okay, see you on Zoom. Okay, God bless you, Peter. Bye now. Okay, our next caller is Earl from Roseville, California. Welcome, Earl.
Hello, Steve. Yeah, last Sunday when I was at my church after the service was over, another Christian brother came up to me and asked me if he can give me a word. So I agreed, but there was another man standing directly behind us. So I just asked him, hey, can we just move to another place in the sanctuary so we can be alone? Because of the personal nature of someone giving me a word that he said is from God. And I also noticed in the past, I think this is common. In other churches, there would be people who didn't seem to be believers just by, how they talked or maybe,
So what can I do for you, Earl? What can I do for you?
Okay, do you think I was being unnecessarily concerned about wanting to be alone so he can give me a word or just not even care about, who might be close to us?
Well, that's up to you. I mean, if someone wants to give you what they consider to be a prophetic word, I assume it's directed to you personally. Otherwise, they'd give it in the meeting. And when Paul said, let the prophet speak two or three and let the others judge, he meant in the meeting, public words, prophecies. If someone comes and says, I have a private prophecy for you, then I think there's every reason that you might wish to be in a private setting for it. Why not? After all, I mean, you never know what it's going to be. It might be something very sensitive. It might be a confrontation about some secret that you and God know about, and maybe the person who has the word knows about, but it's not something you want spread around. I mean, no, for a private prophecy to be given privately is very sensible. I'm not saying it always has to be, But I would think it's not a bad precaution to take. If it's personal, it's personal. Now, I would say this. I've had so many people come with personal prophecies for me that it's awfully hard for me to not be skeptical about them, because there's so many strange and weird ones that have come. But there have been some that have seemed to me to be authentic. And therefore, that's another reason perhaps to be in private. Because if you're going to judge the prophecy, which you're actually told to do in the Bible, if someone gives you a personal prophecy and gives you some direction, and you sense right away that this is not from God, you might have to, you know, turn on it and say, no, that's not true. That's not really, I know that's not from God. And if somebody else was there listening, you might confuse them the more, or they might think that you're the one who's out of line because they heard what the person prophesied to you, and if you didn't accept it as valid, someone else might think, well, you should have, and then it gets spread around more. If there's going to be personal prophecies, I think it's good for them to be in private. They don't have to be, but there's much to be said for it. So, no, I don't think you did the wrong thing, or were being hypersensitive about the situation. Okay, let's talk to Michael from Inglewood, California. Michael, welcome.
Hello. Thanks, Steve. I'm calling because I think it was 1 week or 2 weeks ago, a lady called basically asking if God is an angel or something. I think saying somewhat angels are synonymous with the word spirit. And then I was reading Acts 7:30, where Stephen was talking about Moses. So I got to thinking, and my question is, there was an angel in the bush, and then the Lord spoke to Moses. And then also I think about Jacob as he wrestled with the angel. And is God an angel, or can God be an angel if he wants to? And also kind of not vice versa, but the same thing for the devil. I know he transformed himself to the angel of light. But, yeah, I guess that's my question, if you got it in there.
Yeah, God himself is not what we'd call an angel. There are references in the Bible to the angel of the Lord, or in some cases, an angel of the Lord. Now, if the angel is of the Lord, it's sent from him. But the word angel, in both the Hebrew and in the Greek, in the Old and the New Testament, the word angel is the common word for a messenger. In the Greek, it's angelos. I don't remember at the moment what the Hebrew word is in the Old Testament. In the New Testament, it's angelos. And that word in Greek simply means a messenger. And our word angel comes from it, and it's, of course, in the context of certain usages, it's clearly referring to a supernatural messenger from heaven, a messenger from God. Other uses in other contexts, it's just a human messenger. It's just a messenger. So is God a messenger? Well, if someone is said to be a messenger of the Lord, or the messenger of the Lord, then I presume it's not the Lord himself. Yet, in the Old Testament, the messenger of the Lord, or the angel of the Lord, often speaks as if it is God speaking, as in the case of the bush, the burning bush. As you read the story of the burning bush in Exodus chapters 3 and 4, you find that on occasion it says the Lord spoke from the bush, and then just kind of intermixed in there, it sometimes says, and the angel said this. So it does sound like it's, okay, is the Lord speaking or is the angel speaking? Well, since we're told it's the angel of the Lord, we know that it is a messenger from God, but speaking as God, just as if you're sent to give an oracle, or if you're sent to represent somebody as their messenger. I mean, in a case like this, you might just speak the words of the person who sent you, in which case you're speaking as if you are that person, but it's understood that you're sent from that person. Now, many people have suggested, many evangelical Christians believe, that when you find the expression in the Old Testament, the angel of the Lord, that is with the definite article, the, that it's a specific angel of the Lord, as opposed to when you find the expression, an angel of the Lord, which is the indefinite article, an angel of the Lord. Now, an angel of the Lord could be any number, one of any number of angels, but the angel of the Lord, it's very commonly held, is always a reference in the Old Testament to God, what we call a theophany, an appearance of God. And most Christians would say an appearance of Christ. prior to his birth in Bethlehem. That we, of course, Christian theology teaches that Christ existed forever in heaven before he came to earth. But on occasion, before he came to earth, he did come for as a messenger from his Father, and was is sometimes referred to as the angel of the Lord. Now, I would say if you look up all the places where it uses the term the angel of the Lord, you might find that it's well supported, that that theory does work there. But there are certainly times when the angel talks as if it is the Lord himself. And so, I mean, one of the ways that this is sorted out by Christian theology is to refer to the angel of the Lord as a theophany, or as what we might say a Christophany. Theophany means an appearance of God. Christophany means an appearance of Christ. But these theophanies occur prior to the birth of Jesus in Bethlehem. But they are, it is believed by Christian Trinitarians that this is the word of God, the second person of the Trinity, appearing in a visible or at least audible form. So it's a little complicated, but to say that God is an angel himself, essentially an angel, we'd have to ask, well, who is he the messenger for? A messenger, by definition, is carrying somebody else's message for them. That's what a messenger is. And so a messenger of the Lord is bringing a message from the Lord. But if the Lord himself is an angel, well, who sent him? You know, whose messenger is he? So to say that God is an angel would not really make sense. But to say that there are appearances of God in a form as a visible messenger from God to man, and that's called the angel of the Lord, and to see that as, you know, the second person of the Trinity, as Christians usually speak, appearing to give a message, that's not... That makes sense, and it seems to work with most of the data on the subject.
Hey.
All right. Well, thank you for your call. Let's talk to Jonas from Camarillo, California. Jonas, welcome.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
I was reading through The Time Is at Hand by Jay Adams.
Yeah.
And he makes the interesting assertion that 2 Thessalonians 2 and Revelation 20 are, in fact, describing the exact same events.
I once held that view, too. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I was just wondering why you no longer put that out as a possibility.
Well, I don't reject it. Actually, I had that idea before I read his book back in the early 80s. I think I read his book in 1981, if I'm not mistaken. And I was glad to see that he suggested it, because I had never heard anyone suggest it. For our listeners who don't know what we're talking about, in Revelation 20, there is the binding of Satan for 1,000 years, and then he's released for a little while to deceive the world at the end. And in 2 Thessalonians 2, Paul speaks of the coming of the man of sin, who is a great deceiver, Satan's deceiver, and even used of God to bring strong delusion to those who don't want the truth. And yet Paul says something at the time Paul was writing, something was retaining him. Restricting him, I should say, restraining him, that he could not rise until whatever it is that was restraining him was taken out of the way. So Paul was saying that in his day something was restraining the rise of the man of sin who would deceive with the power of Satan, but he didn't say what it was. But when that is taken away, then the man of sin would come and deceive. And so that fits reasonably with the idea of the 2000—Revelation 20 and the 1,000 years and the little season, that Paul could be speaking of the age of the church as the little season. And once God has removed the restraint, then the man of sin will rise, and that's the little season at the end of Revelation 20. I don't know of any reason why that can't be true. I'm not certain. I will say this, that Revelation 20 does not mention the man of sin or any other individual. When Satan goes out to deceive the nations and all the nations gather against the beloved city in Revelation 20, there's no mention there of a antichrist or man of sin or anyone like that involved, though he very well may be. But we can't be certain. if there was such a mention, then it'd be very tempting to say that's the same as the man of sin that Paul mentioned. But there's no such character mentioned in Revelation 20. But that doesn't mean he's not there, just because it's not mentioned. Likewise, in 2 Thessalonians 2, the man of sin is said to sit in the temple of God, which is Paul's expression elsewhere for the church. And therefore, the man of sin is said to arise in the church, which could be harmonized with Revelation 20, but it's not obvious from Revelation 20 that that's the case. You know, when I teach on 2 Thessalonians, I usually give the view of the reformers about that, that the Roman Empire was what hinders the man of sin, and the man of sin was the papacy. And I only give that because that was the unanimous view of all the reformers and of the Protestants until the 19th century. But it could be wrong. I mean, J. Adams could be right, and I remember I had thought that myself before I read it in J. Adams. And when I read it to him, it sort of felt like a confirmation. So I'm not going to reject that idea. I just don't know that I could, affirm it for sure. I'm sorry, I can't go any further with that right now. I've got to take a break. You're listening to The Narrow Path. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. I'll be back in 30 seconds.
The Narrow Path is on the air due to the generous donations of appreciative listeners like you. We pay the radio stations to purchase the time to allow audiences around the nation and around the world by way of internet to hear and participate in the program. All contributions are used to purchase such airtime. No one associated with The Narrow Path is paid for their service. Thank you for your continued support.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for another half hour taking your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith you'd like to bring up for conversation on the air, we welcome you to do so. The number to call is 844-484-5737. And if you weren't listening in the previous half hour, I want to remind you that the first Wednesday of every month, and that's today, this month, we have in the evening at 7 o'clock Pacific time, a Zoom meeting, where it's, in this case, it's a Q&A meeting, just like the radio show. Goes a little longer than the show does, since we don't have the same restrictions that radio places upon us. And we get more done, I think, more said. But that's tonight, and it doesn't matter what part of the world you're in, except you'll have to adjust the time. Where I am in the Pacific time zone, it's 7 p.m. tonight, and whatever time it is where you are, it may be different, but you can still join us, of course. You go to thenarrowpath.com, our website, click on the tab that says Announcements, find today's date, which is Wednesday, October 4th, and there will be there the information you need to log on to this Zoom meeting. All right. Let's see, we're going to talk next to Rez from the Bay Area. That's the San Francisco Bay Area. Hi, Rez. Welcome.
Hi, Steve. You're definitely not a wimp. Thank you. I just wanted to, it was along the lines of kind of the first caller that talked, and I just wanted to get your input. Personally, I don't know, if I'm even Christian along the lines of what mainstream Christianity is, because I don't know that I can stomach any of it anymore. A lot of it is every time a bird falls out of the sky, it's the end of the world. There's always a prophecy. They're always calling out people in the media that are evil, calling out witches, calling out the Illuminati. And if this is Christianity, I don't want it.
Now, why are you identifying Christianity with any of those things?
Well, to me, because that's what I was exposed to. That's what I was taught is,
Right. But you know better than that. You know better than that. What you were exposed to isn't necessarily what Jesus taught, is it? I think you come out of
not.
Don't you come out of a Seventh-day Adventist background?
Correct.
Okay. Well, I think you reject a lot of Seventh-day Adventism. And I frankly reject a lot of the things I came out of. I wasn't Seventh-day Adventist, but I was raised in evangelical Christianity, and I saw a lot of things too that I don't agree with. But I'm not trying to be loyal to some religion. Christianity is about walking with Jesus Christ. You don't have to have any religion at all to do that. You have to believe in God. You have to believe in Christ. You have to be obedient to Him. You have to be submitted to Him. You need to walk according to His word and be His disciple. That's what being a Christian is. Now, that will make you a part of a worldwide family of those who have done the same thing. That is, all the true disciples of Jesus the world over are part of what God views as His family and the body of Christ. But He doesn't see any organization on earth as His body or His family. Christ didn't start that kind of an organization. He started a family. We don't read of Jesus ever even wanting to start a religion. He might have wanted to, but he was silent about it. If he did, he was calling people to be back, like prodigal sons, come back to their father and be on good terms with their father and be obedient sons and so forth. I don't know of any religious organization which, looking at it on the whole, could be said to be that way. I'm not saying there's no religious organizations that do the best they know how to be good followers of Christ, but there's no organization that everyone in it is a follower of Christ. At least I've never found any. Even certain mission organizations where you might think, well, there'd be a higher density of true followers of Christ there than in the average, church. Well, I don't know. Even in mission organizations, you find many people who are very compromised if they're followers of Christ. It's questionable. But there are also true followers of Christ in virtually every church and every organization that's Christian, and people who aren't in any organizations at all, but who are following Christ. Unfortunately, when you identify Christianity with one or more of these organizations or the sum total of them, then you've got a mixed bag of strange people, including not so strange people. You've got people in these churches who are exemplary followers of Christ and people in the same organizations that are wackos. And if you say, well, I can't accept Christianity anymore, well, then the things you told me about that make you think you're not going to follow that anymore, none of those things have anything to do with Jesus. When a bird falls from the sky, people think it's the end of the world. People are calling out witches and homosexuals all over the place. Paul himself wouldn't do that. Paul said that he had no place judging those who are outside the church about their morality. He said he judged those who are inside the church and that we must do so. In 1 Corinthians 5, he said that at the end of the chapter. He said, what do I have to do with judging those who are outside? For a Christian to go around, pointing the finger at people who aren't even in the church and condemning them for their sins is missing the point entirely. Jesus didn't come to condemn the world. He came that the world would be saved. But once you become a follower of Christ, of course, you come under the discipline of the church, as you must, because once you've committed to Christ, you've committed to being obedient. And there's a church, a body of Christ, that holds your feet to the fire about that. Say, well, if you're going to call yourself a Christian, if you're going to say you're following Christ, you'd better do so, because otherwise you're bringing reproach on Christ and on the rest of us. And so, if you're going to decide whether you want to be a Christian or not, why don't you look at what Christianity really means, what it really means to be a follower of Christ? In other words, look at Jesus, look at the Bible, look at what the Bible says Christians are supposed to do and believe, and then decide if that's where you're at, if that's what you want or not. If not, then... find some other way to think about things. But it makes no sense to look at the strange behavior of persons who call themselves Christians but do things that you know are weird and say, well, I guess I don't want to be a Christian. That's like saying, everybody in my math class gets the answers wrong, so I just don't think I'm going to believe in math anymore. Well, you still have to do math. Math is reality. But if most people get the wrong answers, that doesn't make the whole science disputed or the whole discipline rejected. You just say, well, I guess I better do better math than those people are because they're failing their exams. But I want to get the math right, and therefore I'm going to going to do what I can not to fail the exams. I'm going to try to learn it and follow it correctly. You don't give up on math or science because some people do it wrong. And you don't give up on following Christ because some people do it wrong. At least I don't think a sensible person would. And that's what I think you're trying to be. So I would suggest, focus on Jesus and what the Bible teaches, and then decide if that's what you want. Don't be distracted by your background or religious people you've known. Now, I realize it's hard to say, don't look at, Christians, look at Jesus, because frankly, people are supposed to be able to look at Christians and see Jesus. Where else are they supposed to see him? Well, fortunately, we have the New Testament. We can see him there. But for centuries, people didn't have copies of the New Testament that they could read. And all they could see was the so-called Christians. And Christians have certainly turned many people away from Jesus. Someone said, one of the best evidences for the truthfulness of Christianity is the Christians. And one of the best evidences that Christianity is false is the Christians. Now, what is meant by that is the religious people who claim to be Christians. You meet people who really follow Christ, and they provide among the best possible evidences that Christianity is true. You meet people who claim to follow Christ and don't. Well, unfortunately, they drag the name of Christ in the mud, but not legitimately. He's not down there in the mud. They are. They just claim to be following him down there. And no wonder people get it wrong and don't want it. Okay, Rudy from Rancho Cucamonga, California. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Steve. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I had a question about tongues. I heard just recently from some lady that was saying that she speaks in tongues and that they were trying to get, well, who's interpreting? And she says, well, there's two kinds of tongues. And I was wondering what you think about that. Is there two kinds of tongues, like one that has to have an interpreter and one that doesn't? And my other question is, I heard you talking about Jack Kitts one time about some of his teachings, his beliefs, and I was just wondering, would you or can you recommend going to his church? Is his teachings that bad where you would not recommend going to his church? And I'm going to, if you could put me on mute, because I can't hear very good, and I'm going to put you on speakerphone on my side, if you could please mute me.
Okay. I'll do that. Okay, about tongues. Is there a kind of tongues that doesn't need an interpretation? Well, the Apostle Paul seemed to know of three, I don't know if we'd say three kinds of tongues or three uses of tongues. It might be different kinds. Of course, there was tongues such as Paul talked about in 1 Corinthians 14, which was someone speaking in the church, meaning to the Christians, in tongues, or at least doing it in the presence of Christians. And yet they're speaking a language, Paul said, that nobody understands. And therefore, just as speaking in tongues was considered to be a miraculous thing, the interpretation of the tongue would have to be miraculous too, because neither the speaker nor those listening knew the meaning of the words. So Paul said that you should only do that in the church if there's an interpreter present. That is, if somebody who has the equally supernatural gift of interpreting is present. Paul even said in 1 Corinthians 14, 13, if you speak in tongues, pray that you can interpret it. Which is interesting that you have to pray that you could interpret it. If you were speaking a language that you knew, you wouldn't have to pray that you could interpret it. You could just do it. But he's indicating that God will have to give you the interpretation, just as he has to give you the tongue. But he does say that if there's no interpreter present, he says, just speak to yourself and to God. Now, what that means is, of course, the same tongue that you might, the same utterance in tongues that you might otherwise give publicly in the church if there's someone to interpret it, it could be given under your breath quietly before God when there's no one to interpret it, which means that God is the one who understands it, and you're not going to disturb the church with it because they don't understand it and there's no one there to make it understandable. But he didn't say don't speak at all. He just says speak to yourself and to God. You see, in the opening verses of 1 Corinthians 14, he says that the person who speaks in tongues is not speaking to men, but to God, for no one understands him, he says. And so it's prayer. Speaking in tongues, in that case, is prayer. And it may be a prayer that can be interpreted for the benefit of the congregation to hear, if there's an interpreter, or if there's no one interpreting, then it can be said quietly with no one listening except God, because prayer, it's okay to pray when no one but God hears. Now, there's another kind of tongues that's in the Bible, and that's what happened on the day of Pentecost. Now, this is very different, because this was a public spectacle to the unbelievers. Paul even says in 1 Corinthians 14 that tongues can be a sign to unbelievers. However, it's not a sign to unbelievers when somebody in the church speaks in a tongue that no one understands, even when there's interpretation, because first of all, Paul did not assume that the church was a place where a lot of unbelievers would be. The church is a fellowship of believers. But tongues happened on the day of Pentecost out in public, essentially, where the multitudes out in the streets could hear it. And what they heard was people supernaturally speaking in languages that the speakers did not know, but which the hearers did. They were speaking, these people were from all over the world and spoke foreign dialects, and they heard these Galileans in Jerusalem speaking all these different dialects, which they would almost certainly not know. And the people marveled. They said, how can these Galileans all be speaking in languages that we understand? In other words, you didn't need an interpreter then either. That was a different kind of tongues, because it was, in fact, speaking a language that was known to the hearers. And if you're speaking a language that, even if you don't know it, if your hearers know it, you don't need to interpret it for them. So that would be a use of tongues when it's assigned to the unbelievers, where you're speaking their language supernaturally, but you don't need to interpret it for them because it's their language. They know what you're saying. You don't, but they do. Now, that's different than the kind of tongues Paul talks about in the church in 1 Corinthians 14, where he says no one understands them. And that's why you need an interpreter. So it does seem like tongues, which is spoken as a sign to unbelievers, is a different kind of tongues than that which is spoken for the edification of the church. And that tongues that's spoken in the church must have an interpretation, because no one otherwise will understand it. And if there's no interpreter present, then that same tongues apparently can be used simply in private conversation with God. So it seems like there's three possible uses of tongues in the Bible. One is, of course, speaking to unbelievers in their own language. Another is speaking in the church with an interpretation. And the third is speaking privately to God in a tongue, also apparently without interpretation. So, because if there was interpretation, then it wouldn't be necessary to keep it private. So the privacy, tongues in private, doesn't need an interpretation either. Although it would require it if you're going to understand it. The thing is, you don't have to understand it because you're not talking to you. You're talking to God, and he understands it. So that's how I understand what the Bible says about tongues. Now, about Jack Hibbs. Jack Hibbs is, I assume, a very good, fine Christian man. I don't know otherwise. He's a pretty effective and popular teacher. The differences I have with him, I don't know how many differences I have with him. The one difference I'm aware of is that he's a dispensationalist, and I'm not. But then that's true of many, many teachers that are well-respected. I would never single Jack Hibbs out and say, oh, look out for him, he's a false teacher, because he's a dispensationalist. Well, if I were to do that, I'd have to label, most of the preachers on the radio and a whole bunch of other famous Christian authors, because they're dispensationalists too. I don't refer to dispensationalists as heretics, and I don't warn people not to listen to dispensationalists. Frankly, some of my favorite teachers and some of those who've influenced me the most have been dispensationalists. Now, the only thing I've ever said about Jack Hibbs is that he made a video on YouTube where he said some very irresponsible things about something that's related to theology I understand to be true. And so I made a video answering those things. It was not an attack on him. There were two other teachers on his video too. I wasn't attacking them either. I was just answering the things I was frankly refuting points they made that needed refutation. But do I recommend that it be bad to go to his church? I've never been to his church, so I don't know how good it is. He's got lots of people coming who like him, but the size of a church doesn't necessarily tell you of it. He's definitely a very dynamic, charismatic kind of a speaker, enjoyable to listen to. I've heard him on the radio. He's enjoyable to listen to be sure. Exactly how much shepherding, how much discipleship goes on in his church, I don't know. So I can't recommend his church or say that his churches should be avoided. I don't have a position about it. I would say that many of our listeners do go to dispensational churches, and that's okay. I sometimes go to dispensational churches. I have many times. And some of our listeners are not dispensationalists, but they still go to dispensational churches. As long as the church will let you do that, then feel free to do it. I don't tell anyone not to go to anyone's church. Now, I mean, I would suggest that going to the Mormon church or going to the Kingdom Hall of the Jehovah's Witnesses is a real bad idea, unless your faith is so strong that you're going to be able to hear it and understand what's wrong there. But I can't see what you'd go there for. I don't know that there's much positive to be gotten from groups like that. But many dispensational churches, even if I disagree with their dispensationalism, they have other strengths. They have other things about them that would be worth going to. Not being familiar with Jack Hibbs' church, I can't say whether his is one of those or not, but it could well be. So I'm not a critic of Jack Hibbs' church, nor necessarily of his teaching in general. But I did refute some of the things he said. By the way, for those who are wondering what that was all about, you can go to YouTube and just or even Google and just type in the words Jack Hibbs and Steve Gregg, and right up the video will come up that I'm talking about, Jack Hibbs and Steve Gregg. But that's the only answer I've given to Jack Hibbs about anything. It's not like I'm a critic of Jack Hibbs. I'm just a critic of, you know, any teachers making statements that are irresponsible and wrong, just because I'm sure he made them sincerely, but I think he made them without thinking very much about them before making them, and that's something that I thought required some kind of an answer. All right, let's talk to Max from Portland, Oregon. Hi, Max. Good to hear from you.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for picking up my call. Hey,
sure.
In the first half, you sort of, I just want to sort of see if I heard you right. You were talking there, a gentleman who was discussing, you know, if people can fall away from the faith. And
yeah.
I heard the word wimp used and tossed around. I'm just curious if you think that if people who fall away from Christianity were maybe born into it, as it were, if people like me, if we're wimps, or if we're just maybe afraid of commitment, or if, as you also sort of insinuated, if you're open to the possibility that we simply honestly changed our minds after receiving more information or different information.
Right.
You're just kind of riff on that.
Okay. What I was calling a wimp is somebody who either leaves their marriage or Christianity, either one of which is breaking a vow, you know, and when they don't need to. Now, there are times when new information may tell you that the person you married was not who you thought they were. They might not even be. They might have been already married to someone else, for example. In other words, you might find that you've married somebody that you shouldn't be married to, in which case you're not a wimp to get out of it. You're just kind of rectifying a bad situation. Now, if you made a commitment to Christ when you were young and didn't have any knowledge of what you were doing and you hadn't thought things through, then that wasn't really, you know, we don't hold children accountable for commitments they made. That's why we don't let, you know, children vote, and we don't let children go to war, and we don't let children get married and things like that. You know, when children make commitments, we're willing to let them out of them if they reach adulthood and find out that their commitment was badly made. Now, as far as I know, there's never been a good reason to leave Christ, but I know there's a lot of propaganda against him out there that can lead a person to feel like, well, I hadn't thought this through when I was a kid. Now I'm hearing all these things that make me wonder, and I realize I never really made an intelligent decision or a mature and responsible decision to be a Christian. Therefore, I'm gonna go search it out and find out what I believe instead. I wouldn't call that wimp. I wouldn't call that being a wimp, because a person has not actually made a responsible adult decision in the first place that they're backing out of. Go ahead.
Do you think someone can make an intelligent decision to not be a Christian?
I don't think they can make a very well-informed decision to not be a Christian, no. I think that...
That's not my question.
Okay.
Do you think someone can make an intelligent decision to not be a Christian?
Well, a person can be intelligent and make a bad decision based on bad information. That's what I'm saying. I think if a person's well-informed and intelligent, I don't think there'd be any reason to give up their faith. But there are intelligent people who are not well informed, and on the basis of the flawed information that they've received, they might intelligently give up on Christ because they've been misinformed now and realize that they don't really have good reason to believe in their faith because they haven't searched it out before. But I think that a person who hears, most people who leave the faith, at least when they give their reasons to me, most of it's emotional reasons, but then when they have something like an intellectual reason, it's usually based on really poorly researched data. And data that I've heard and looked at it myself, and I realized that, well, if they'd simply done a little more research, they'd realize that that data that caused them to give up their faith was pretty slanted and not well verified. I think, you know, not everyone doesn't have the same information available and therefore makes different decisions.
So to summarize, you don't think people who left the faith are necessarily wimps or necessarily unintelligent. You just think that they're misinformed.
Well, I think that if someone made an informed decision at the beginning, just like when you get married, you hopefully have an informed decision you're making, that they should keep their vow. They should stay faithful unless they learn something that makes it impossible for them to honestly do so. I think people need to be honest. That's really my bottom line. People need to have integrity. When people say they're going to do something, they should. Now, if they actually learn actual facts that show that it was a very bad idea to make the decision they made and they back out, then that might be the honest thing to do. However, I think a lot of people leave both their faith and their marriages for reasons that aren't good at all, you know, but because it relieves them or of some burden or whatever that they didn't like to carry.
Well, now you sort of up the odds here, because now it's almost a characterization of saying that people who intellectually have reasons to leave their faith are dishonest with themselves. Am I summarizing you correctly?
No, I would say people who think they have intellectual reasons to leave the faith have not searched out as much as they should. In that sense, we might say they're not as honest as they could be because they've bought into a conclusion when there's other data that they're not caring to look at. Or it may be that there's data they haven't encountered yet, in which case they could be honest because all the data they know points them toward an unbelief. But if they knew more, I believe they would realize that there's no data that would undermine the Christian faith.
That's so interesting because you've really set up a one-way street here, because on the one hand, you certainly would not chastise someone born into unbelief, as it were, you know, an atheist family, for instance, but then finding intellectual reasons or even emotional reasons to convert to Christianity, I presume that you wouldn't give them any grief if it were the
right
other direction.
Right, because
right.
I don't know very many atheists who've made a solemn commitment to remain atheists all their lives, no matter what they learn. Basically, becoming a Christian is a solemn vow to be faithful to Jesus Christ, just like when you get married, you make a solemn vow to be faithful to your spouse. And, you know, unless you find out that Jesus is not, you know, genuine or not what you once thought he was, there's no getting out of it, you know, honestly, because you made a commitment. Now, I don't know of any atheists who made that kind of a commitment to be an atheist. And therefore, if they change their views, they're not breaking any promises that I know of. I'd love to go into this more, Max. You know I would, but we're out of time here. I'm being cut off here in 10 seconds, so I'm going to have to let you go. But we'll talk again in the future. You're listening to The Narrow Path. We are listener-supported. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. And let's talk again tomorrow. God bless.